To start the presentation recording now. Go ahead, Patricia.
Derek Arden and I first met in Indianapolis at the National Speakers Association Convention in 2012. At the time, he was chairman of the board of directors of the Professional Speakers Association in UK and Ireland. And his goal was to negotiate with me that I would keynote their 2014 convention. And when you speak at another speaker convention, that means you pay your own business class airline ticket and hotel and all expenses, and you work very hard for nothing. So I counter-negotiated with him that I would probably not do it. However, I would give him four trips of picking me up at the airport, taking me to Bournemouth, which was a 2.5 hour drive each way for him. So he managed to negotiate that I said yes, and I negotiated a lifetime chauffeur service every time I go to England. I think I got the better deal. Now, Derek, before he was a speaker, author, trainer, and consultant, had a real job. After a long and distinguished career at Barclays Bank, handling many complex negotiations, he became the person he is now, author, a speaker on negotiation, sales, and influencing. He has studied at Harvard and with many European experts, so now he is an acknowledged leading expert in negotiations in Europe. He's the author of 10 books, including Win-Win, How to Get a Winning Result from Persuasive Negotiations. It's been translated into Chinese and Bulgarian. Since the beginning of the pandemic, he's also conducted 57 of live chat shows similar to this, and he hosts his own podcast channel and has more than 150 videos on YouTube. Derek is a fellow in the Institute of Bankers, the Institute of Management and Professional Speaking Association. He has been elected to the UK Speaker Hall of Fame, and he's spoken in 32 different countries. He lives in Guildford, Surrey with his wife, Sally. They've been married for 45 years and they have a holiday home in Swanage Beach in Dorset, where I came from. And that's where he does most of his writing. So ladies and gentlemen, if you have pinned Derek's video, sit back and enjoy my good friend, my UK chauffeur, a passionate educator, and a negotiation expert, Derek Arden.
Wow, what an introduction, Patricia. Thank you so much for that. And thank you so much, everybody, Mr. President, for inviting me to your prestigious Breakfast Club, which I understand has been running for 76 years. I love San Francisco. I've been to San Francisco five times, and I'll tell you about one of my negotiating experiences in San Francisco a little later, if I may. But no one told me that when you stay in San Francisco, you should stay at Fisherman's Wharf, because you can get the trolley without a 150-mile queue, as I had to get the first time I came at the West End. But I understand there's somebody on here that runs the bus company, so that's great. I would like to negotiate a free trip on the trolley next time I join you. Patricia's always keen to ask me how I got into negotiations. And I have to tell you, I had one of those life-changing experiences about 25 years ago. I was the Barclays account director for all the retailers in the UK, and Tesco was one of mine. Tesco's at that time was the third largest retailer in the world after Walmart and Nordstrom, and I was negotiating with them. Well, I went to their HQ in Cheshunt, just outside London, a not very nice part of North London, where they had their cheap and cheerful HQ. And it was to talk about the price on a £1 million contract. And the first thing the finance director said to me, without any small talk, any rapport at all, He said, I hope you've got a better price than you put to us in your pitch. And I started talking about service delivery and all those things that us salespeople and negotiators do. And he said, Derek, it's about price. Have you got a better price? And I said, well, not really. And he said, well, you better leave. And at this point, he stood up, walked me to the door. And I'd been in his room about a minute. And I could feel those tingles of perspiration, which I hoped he didn't see, coming across my brow, as we do sometimes when we're under pressure. And he walked me to the door. And I was sitting on Chesant Station, wondering, with sweat still going down the back of my shirt, how I was going to explain to the chairman of Barclays Bank, Andrew Buxton, that I'd just lost a £1 million contract with Tesco. Well, that evening I went into London to our HQ, still with this wobbly feeling that one gets sometimes when things aren't going right. And I went into Waterstones with the bookshop, a bit like Barnes & Noble, and bought a book called Everything is Negotiable. And that book was the only book at that time written by a Brit. And on the train home, I got a long commute. I live in Guildford in Surrey, 30 miles outside London. On the commute home, I was reading it and thinking, I didn't know that. I didn't realise that. Derek, really, you're an amateur negotiator at the moment and you're negotiating with the professionals. So you better sharpen up. You better get a grip. And then I ordered Nightingale Conant tapes. They were tapes those days. So that's how old I am, listening to Roger Dawson, your Californian expert, and everybody I could get my hands on. And I never believed that I would be the best-selling author of a book called Win-Win 25 years later. But that was the story of how I got into it. And from that moment onwards, I decided I was going to learn everything I possibly could about negotiation skills. And I have. And I'm surprised at how many people think they're good negotiators, but actually, when push comes to shove, they generally aren't. And the negotiation I wanted to tell you about in San Francisco took place at the Westin Hotel on Union Square. And I'd been sent to North America to have a look at the Body Shop account. The Barclays directors weren't very happy with the lending to Body Shop. This is a long time ago, so I can share that with you. They weren't very happy. So they said, Derek, we want you to go to Toronto, or Toronto, as they say, I know, in Canada, and then to San Francisco. So we flew to Toronto and we met the head franchisee of Body Shop. And then we went to the airport to catch our flight to SFO. And it's 5 hours late, Air Canada. So we have a couple of beers, as you do. And we arrive finally at SFO at 2:30 in the morning. We catch a cab to the Westin. And I'd been talking to my colleague from New York, an investment banker from New York who was with me. And I've been talking about negotiation skills. And he said, well, come on then. We're only going to be in the Westin for 4 hours. You better negotiate us a deal. Well, on the basis that Barclays was paying for it, I thought, well, I'll have a go. I'll see if I can show off. So I used every negotiation tactic I could. We went into the reception. I talked to the receptionist. I connected with her. I built rapport. I mirrored and matched her body language, all those things that we do as professional negotiators. And then I leaned in and just said, look, it's 9:30 in the morning in London. I only came 24 hours ago. It's 6 o'clock in the morning in Toronto. We're being picked up outside at 7:30 in the morning. Would you be able to give us a discount? And notice how I lean forward as I say that quietly in a soft way. And she said, yeah, you are only going to be here for 4 hours. Okay, would 50% be okay? And I tried not to laugh at that point. I said, well, I guess it would be. And I got a 50% discount. And I turned around, went out of her reach to my friend and said, look, that's how you do it. Negotiations are easy, isn't it? We want to talk about Zoom negotiations for you today, because we talked about pre-COVID, post-COVID negotiations. Things are different. And I'm going to stand up now. Forgive me. I want to show you a couple of things on the flip chart. I'm going to have to move the flip chart forward. But I think Zoom presents...
Derek, excuse me, you're going to have to take off the image behind you because we can't see your flip chart.
Thank you. Thank you, Patricia. How's that? Right. You usually need an assistant on these sort of things, and it's nice to have Patricia as my assistant. Usually I'm hers. So that makes me feel a lot better. But this is what I've been talking to a client of mine about. And he has been actually involved in a negotiation in San Francisco, a mediation in San Francisco. I'll tell you a little bit about that in a minute. But apart from all the normal things we should do on a negotiation, I'm just trying to get rid of that shadow that's showing on me. Apart from all the normal things we should do on Zoom, this is what I suggest every one of us should think about. Number one, the setup. Who is organizing the Zoom meeting? Because if you organize it, you've got much more control of the controls. In fact, you can record it with their permission, of course, but you can play the recording back straight away, watch the body language, watch the tactics they used on them. Brief your team beforehand. Clearly you would do that by phone, etc. And then make sure everything's professional. Make sure you dress just like you would to meet a client in a professional situation. Absolutely vital. Why would you dress down just because you're at home when you're dealing with a professional situation? Make sure you take a time out. Vitally important, taking a break, taking a time out. But I suggest if you do that, and when you do it, you close down the Zoom, because there was a case in London last month where there was a big case going on between Barclays Bank actually and a woman called Amanda Staveley, and it was for $1 billion. And they didn't shut off the Zoom, and the lawyer in the court could hear him say, "Well, she's a lying bitch," which clearly wasn't helpful when it got reported in the newspapers, etc., the next day. So I would shut your Zoom down and then go back on it, and then call on your phone your colleagues that are watching it, and to say, well, how much do you think we have to go down? What do you think we have to do? What tactics did they use? What are we looking at? I would also have a flip chart, because one of the most difficult things is recording what people have agreed. And if you can put it on a flip chart in the sight of everybody, then there's no going back on what's been agreed. Remember, there's a time lag on Zoom, which doesn't make life easy. And Zoom fatigue is something that lots of people have been talking about. And finally, remember, tactics work just the same in a Zoom call as they do normally. So beware of Shark Tank tactics, as I call them, people not telling you the truth, lying, fibbing, inventing false time deadlines, and all the things that go on in normal negotiation situations. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd just like to put something in the chat box now. I'd like you to score yourself as a negotiator on a scale of 0 to 100, because I'm very interested to see the scores that come up from the Golden Gate Breakfast Club. And Patricia, if you wouldn't mind just taking a look and telling me what the average score might be as it comes up. And in the meantime, I'm going to carry on telling you my story about my client. My client was using a mediator in San Francisco 2 weeks ago. I better not tell you too much more. He was in London. There were 20 people on the mediation. It took 8 hours. There was no satisfactory conclusion after 8 hours. So not only did they have Zoom fatigue, they were also could think straight about any negotiations when that happens. And what he said to me was, he said, the problem is the mediator didn't know how to work Zoom. So the mediator tried to put us in breakout rooms, and it took 20 minutes to get the right people in the right breakout rooms. Didn't know how to bring people back from the breakout rooms. There was no structured agenda on the whole thing. So he said, to be honest, it was a shambles. It all ended in no agreement, and it's going to arbitration in 2 years' time. What a waste of money. What a waste of time. What a waste of negotiation time. And just think about all those legal fees that people are running up. So absolutely extraordinary situation there. So he's not quite sure what's going on. They're a company that doesn't have particular cash flow problems, so they don't particularly have issues, but it's going to take 2 years to settle. But if there's an enormous amount of contractors involved, that's going to cause a huge issue. Well, I don't know, Patricia, have we got sort of an average score coming up in the box?
Well, we have a few people. Interestingly enough, all your students rate themselves a lot higher than most. Now, Betty Taish and Reg Young are both high on the score with 75, Chuck Hooper 80. Most of us, including me, are lower, 20, 30, up to 60. So I would say, Derek, you have an eager audience.
Well, thank you, Patricia.
Very smart. Just because they've learned before, your students are back, and I bet Betty is paying a lot of attention, even though she's superb.
Just a couple of points on that, Patricia. They've all, of course, the British people have been on my splendid advanced negotiation course, so they would be better, and they've been reading all my books and listening to all my audio. So that's. Fantastic. The people in the US, I wonder if they're really in real estate or something like that, who are the good negotiators? I don't know. The reason I ask that question at an early stage when I run my seminars is because it doesn't matter how you score yourself. What it does matter is what you take away from a seminar, from a workshop, from a keynote that you put into practice, because action's the key. And how much you can move yourself, Patricia, from 30 to 35 or to 40, or from 80 plus, as Peter says he is, to 90. Because the real question is, in post-COVID, how good's good enough? Because I can see some extraordinary negotiations going on Zoom, which people haven't thought about these issues. And of course, these issues are on top of these issues. And these issues are my negotiator's score sheet from my book. And I'm with time, I'm just going to run through them very, very quickly before we throw it open to your audience for questions. So number one on my score sheet is preparation and planning. Absolutely making sure you do your preparation and you position where you want to be. In the US, I find people dress a lot smarter than people do in the UK. You can always dress down if you want to, but you certainly can't dress up. So you can dress down to mirror match the other side. Having a structured agenda, sending it out in advance, asking the other side what they'd like to add to the agenda is critically important. If they tell you what they want to add, they might tell you something that you didn't know they were going to discuss. No surprises in the meeting. And also working out your positions. What's your best position, target position, walk away position, or as I call it in the UK, your alternative position, but Harvard call it a BATNA, B-A-T-N-A, best alternative to a negotiated agreement. They can always move, but not having that in your mind, not planning that and thinking about it. Number two, first impressions. You don't get a second chance to make a first impression. Where are you going to sit in the meeting? How are you going to take the strong position at the meeting table? How are you going to come across? How are you going to greet people? How are you going to connect, build rapport? Number three, asking really high quality questions. The quality of the questions you ask determines the quality of the answers you get. And number four, listening.
really listening to what the person's saying, what they're saying, what they're not saying, how they're saying it, the tone of voice, whether they're telling you fibs, lies, whatever you want to call it, because you'll make better decisions if you look at that carefully. And I'll come to that in a minute. I'm an avid, Patricia, as you know, mind mapper. There's my mind map for today with your audience. I always do a new mind map before a negotiation, before a presentation, so that I can get all the facts out in that mind mapping technique. That's what number five, use your head, is all about. But it's also about speed reading. A lot of my clients don't know how to speed read. Now, the faster you can read, the more information that you can gather. So speed reading, mind mapping, brainstorming, left and right brain techniques to get the maximum information. Then I come to body language, reading the body language. According to the experts, it's five times more difficult to lie with your body language than it is with the words. So when people say, yep, it's really great to be here with you guys today, and they start scratching their nose and fiddling with their faces, perhaps they're not telling you the truth, because we all know that Pinocchio's nose grew every time he told a lie. And that goes back to the 15th century in Venice and Verona. That's where Pinocchio came from. And therefore, you know, we need to be able to make good business decisions on the basis of the information that we are being given. And clearly, people won't tell you the truth always when they're negotiating. Then I come to tactics. Good guy, bad guy, linked to higher authority, using time as a tactic, taking breaks, taking timeouts, and the old famous flinch. You know, the one where you go, how much? You've got to be joking. And of course, the most famous flinch was at the United Nations in New York when President Khrushchev and Mr. Kennedy, where President Kennedy were negotiating the nuclear situation with Cuba, and Khrushchev took his shoe off, or allegedly took his shoe off, bashed the table with his shoe. And when they played the Pathé News video back, whatever it was in those days, for the 10th time, they noticed the assistant pass a shoe to Khrushchev, particularly to bash the table. And as we know, in half the world, putting your shoe on the table, showing the soles of your feet, is one of the biggest insults that you can give people. And I'm going to come to negotiation overseas in a minute, because it really is important that we get the cultural issues right. So I could spend a whole session talking about negotiating tactics, and I'll answer any questions afterwards. The most important thing about a tactic is understanding that it is actually a tactic to get you to reduce your position down to your walk away position, or even lower. Number nine is influencing skills. I'm a massive fan of Dr. Robert Cialdini from the University of Phoenix in Arizona, and his six traits of influencing, which are: does the person like you? What can you give them for nothing? Reciprocity. Do you have the authority? Scarcity. Commitment. And I've forgotten what the sixth one is, so I know you'll forgive me for that, and someone will remind me in a minute. Number 10 is bargaining. We can talk about haggling, bargaining, until the cows come home. The key issue with it is that you make concessions on the basis that you get something in return. It's so if I do this for you, what will you do for me? And I think the best one is really when I met you in Indianapolis and I said, would you come and speak at our convention? And you said no. Actually, you said no. And I went, oh, okay, well, I'm not giving up here. So never give up in a negotiation. So, and then you thought about it. And I think I said, well, I know you come from Wimborne and you used to catch a bus to Bournemouth, because I'd heard your tapes and all the rest of it. So I'd done my research. And then you said, if you pick me up at Heathrow when you fly over. The funny thing was, I was a bit shocked when you sent me your ticket and it was 6:15 on a bank holiday Monday to pick you up. But I got over that quite quickly. But the bit I didn't get over was I went to Terminal 1 and you arrived at Terminal 2, I think. And the problem with Heathrow is Terminal 1 and Terminal 2 are a long way apart. And there you were calling me. But yeah, good win-win negotiation. Win for me, win for you, and a win for our ongoing friendship. And that's what I call win-win negotiations. Win-win-win. Win for me, win for you, and a win for our business relationships. And statistically, it costs seven times more to get a brand new customer than it does to get a recommendation from an existing one, or more information, or testimonials, etc., etc. Ladies and gentlemen, then we come to conflict. There'll always be conflict in a negotiation. So how you handle conflict is up to you. But the Thomas Kilman Conflict Mode Instrument is a particularly good one to analyze your own conflict, but even more important to analyze the people that negotiate on your behalf. Because if they're accommodators or avoiders, as Kilman calls it, then they won't like negotiating. And they're going to come back and say, boss, I got the best deal I possibly could, but it will usually be at the walkaway position you authorize them to do. So understand the people that negotiate for you. And then we come to confidence. And of course, confidence comes from doing your research, going through all that, really understanding the sales influencing and negotiation environment. So ladies and gentlemen, that's my score sheet very quickly, but I would like to, with your permission, I think we've got a few minutes, just to show you this slide that I've put up there. I'm just gonna have to move slightly out the way to show you this. I'm gonna move over here. That should put me over here. You have to get used to this on Zoom. This is a chart that's been drawn up by a person called Erin Mayer, of which countries are more confrontational than others and which countries are more emotionally expressive. And this is quite interesting. So the most confrontational country is Israel, followed by France and Russia, as you can see in the top left-hand corner. I put a red marker by Israel. Surprisingly to me, I always thought you were a little bit more confrontational in the USA than we were in Britain, but you're slightly more confrontational. But my experience isn't quite like that. I thought you were a bit more. And I remember when I went to Nido Quibane's High Point University to study, Nido particularly told me he felt that the UK was a bit softer than the average American negotiator, and that was my feeling. Interestingly enough, down the bottom right-hand corner, Japan and Korea are avoiding confrontation and less emotionally expressive, which is another piece of information. All I would say to you is I've traveled all over the world and I've seen different negotiations in different countries with different people. The key issue is do your research, find out what the local cultures are, find out what the local things that you should do is, and do your research and perhaps get someone from that country to accompany you to the negotiation who's on your side, who can advise you. I had a client that told me a story. They went to Japan and they threw their business card across the table at the Japanese. That's one of the worst things you can possibly do, because that's an insult. The Japanese business card is a extension of that person. And then the guy, the Brit, wrote on the back of the card, which is something we might do in Britain, something you must never do in Tokyo. So absolutely blew the whole thing on the negotiations. For a bit of fun, when I'm doing a keynote, I give out these cards. I'm not sure. Oh, yeah, you might be able to see it. It's the background's slight problem. It says mature student discount card. I confirm this person's a student, mature, and is entitled to a discount. And our friend Tim Gard saw me do this, and Tim Gard did a joint venture with me which he called the ultimate discount card, and he got printed on the back. Just give the person a discount. Don't argue. Don't be pathetic, etc., etc. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to leave you before I answer any questions. I'm just going to put this back onto the normal screen. If you don't ask, you don't get. And if you don't listen, you won't hear what the client's saying. My name's Derek Arden. Thank you for inviting me to the Golden Gate Breakfast Club. It's been a huge honour, and I'd be delighted to stay on the line as long as you'd like me to, Patricia, to answer any questions.
This is Bert.
First of all, let's give Derek an applause, because that was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
There you go.
I appreciate that a lot.
Yeah, and we got a lot of people on the call today, so why don't we, Patricia, I think you have something to say, so why don't we go ahead and, Patricia, you know, we can stick around for some question and answer for a bit. Go ahead.
Derek, I would love you to tell everyone, oh, and Janice B. Gordon is here. I hadn't noticed her slip in, part of the Heathrow gang in England. Derek, could you tell them the story about when you were negotiating in France and they thought you were going to fly out?
Oh, yes. You remember that then? Where was I driving you then? Down the M3 when I told you that? Down the motorway. Well, we had a horrific situation that I was involved in, where we hadn't taken the security properly on a vineyard in Bordeaux. Chateau Margaux, it was actually fabulous, red Bordeaux wine. And we were negotiating a compromise situation, and the French people wouldn't come to London, so we had to fly to Paris. They wouldn't see us till 5:30 in the evening. And my boss said, Derek, book us into a hotel around the corner. We booked into the Winston Churchill Hotel in Paris. Don't tell them that we're booked into the hotel. I said to my boss, his name was Sinbad Coleridge, Sinbad the sailor, they used to call him behind his back. And we did that. And he said, arrange for us to have a French speaker, Derek, that speaks French, but tell the French speaker that they must never let on they speak French. So they they always speak to us in English. Anyway. The team we were negotiating with turned up late, about an hour late, kept us waiting till about 6:30, got us into the room. We sat one side of the table, they sat the other. Another learning point from a negotiation: you never want to sit across the table in a confrontational situation. 80% of people do in 80% of the world, but so that's because they're not thinking negotiators or salespeople. Anyway, the negotiations went on for about an hour and a half. When they took a timeout, they spoke in French. When we took a timeout, we went out the room and down the corridor so that our French translator could tell us what they'd been saying to each other. And of course, they'd been saying, these stupid Brits, they'll agree to this in a minute. They've got to catch the 9:45 flight from Charles de Gaulle Airport back to London Heathrow. And so, you know, about 8:15, they'll agree. Well, we weren't going to agree to anything because we didn't have to. We had quite a strong negotiating position. And it got to about 8:30. And suddenly the lead negotiator, the French guy, started going pale because he realized that the pressure he was putting on us wasn't getting anywhere. And apparently he'd organized dinner with his French mistress. We understood it was his French mistress, not his wife afterwards, at 10 o'clock. So you can imagine what happened. But the other thing that happened in it, which you may remember, Patricia, was that we were sent to a breakout room to make our calls back to London for authority, because this was £10 million. This was 100,000 French francs in those days, about 15 million euros. And my boss said, don't say anything, Derek, in this room. I have a feeling it's bugged. And they'd actually said, we've set up a room for you to make your calls back. Well, I'm a good listener, and I heard the words set up, and I thought, I don't want to be set up by these people. So what we did was we went outside and we had a walk along the Champs-Élysées or wherever it was to have our discussions. So we didn't come to a conclusion that day. We didn't fall for their negotiation tactics. They didn't get us down to our walkaway position. And in fact, we came back a week later and got a satisfactory negotiation deal. But they were sure, and remember where France sits on that chart, and I've been reminding people in Britain on the Brexit negotiations, and I sent our Prime Minister a copy of my book, personalised, and I did get a nice reply from the previous Prime Minister, Mrs. May, but Boris didn't bother to reply, but never mind. I'll remind him of that one day if I can. So the lesson there is be prepared, make sure that you keep some of the things secret to yourself. I'm sure people will assume that English people, American people, Canadian people, well, Canadian people probably do speak another language because of French Canada, but don't speak another language. And it's all in the planning and the preparation. I learned a huge lot there from Sinbad. And that story and the Tesco story were all at about the same time. And that's when I decided that negotiation, I was going to teach negotiation. And when I negotiated my way from Barclays, that's what I do.
Derek, that was fantastic. And I think you just illustrated the power of telling a great story, because that was a fantastic story, you know, and it's like when we walk away, we're going to remember that story. So thanks for sharing that. James, you have a question, James Stewart, and then follow that up with Bert Hill.
Oh, I was just curious, because you mentioned that you never sit across from the table in a negotiations. Where do you recommend sitting? Position yourself?
Yeah, can I put it on the flip chart? So this is what can you see this? Yeah, this
yes.
is what I said to my client. The average negotiation table anywhere in the world is rectangular, and it looks like this. And 80% of people will sit like that, probably 4 foot apart. Now, in the English language, we have a saying, don't we? How far apart are we? Now, where does that come from? It comes basically because an arm's length deal is a good deal. And arm's length is about 2'6", I guess. I don't know. We used to shake hands, don't we? An arm's length deal might be a nudge now where I come from. But so that's what people generally say. This is what I recommend. Doesn't always work, but gives you a clue. Now, you're going to get there early because you're a professional negotiator. So you should be the first person in the room. If you're the first person in the room, I recommend you put your papers, there. But you don't sit down. You don't sit down because you want to be upright. You want to be confident when they come in. You want to greet them, even if you're in their premises. Why not? Let's take the high ground. Let's build rapport. Let's mirror match their body language and whatever we can do to get them to like us, because people buy from people like ourselves. It's a PLM syndrome, isn't it? People like me syndrome. Now, the worst thing that can happen here is they sit there. If they sit there, you know, you now know you're in big trouble anyway, don't you? Because you're about 10 feet apart. But if they do that, you could still pick up your papers, come round here and sit there. Let me get a new piece of paper. You asked me the ideal position. The ideal position is we are sitting across the end of the desk. But as I told you, Body Shop was one of my clients. Now, Gordon Roddick was the chief executive. If you went into Gordon's office, you'd find a big round table in the middle. You'd find all his computer kit round the outside. And you'd sit round the table with Gordon, as King Arthur did, sitting round the table. And again, of course, this is the most ideal situation. But of course, most offices don't have rectangular tables because... they're measured on, and you're a real estate man, Craig, aren't you, I think? Are you a real estate? Yeah. Well, you know, this is so much a square foot, isn't it? Round tables don't work very well in the real estate industry.
I like the round table analogy.
Oh, it's great, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah. And I would always have a round table in my office if I could, and I'd always have a flip chart. Now, most people don't do that. I have a flip chart for the simple reason that when someone agrees to something, if you can write it on the flip chart straight away, there can be no misunderstanding. They've given you a concession at that point. If you write it on an A4 piece of paper, that's just your piece of paper. Here, they can't go back on it. And I can go back later and say, well, Patricia, I thought I heard you agree to $20,000 for that particular issue, plus 25 copies of your book or whatever. So you can go back to it. It's visual. And as we know, visual information is 18 times more powerful than audio information in the way we process it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question, James?
Yes. Much appreciated.
If you find yourself, and you will find yourself, sitting across the table, make a mental note of yourself to try and make sure that doesn't happen. These little tiny things like building rapport, connecting with people, shaking hands in the old days, remembering what soccer team they support, what baseball team they support, an American football team, and things like that, what the names of their children are, where they went on holiday, make a massive difference. And we know most people don't bother with that. Well, they certainly don't bother in Europe. Maybe you guys do, but it's hugely powerful.
Thank you. But
it makes the negotiation more effective for sure, but also it makes it more enjoyable for everybody. I mean, you know, what'd you say? It was a PLM, people like me?
PLM, people like me. People buy from people they like. People buy, build rapport with people from their own tribe, if we take it back to caveman. And that's one of the problems, isn't it, with some of the negotiations going on in the world now. A lot of the history of the Middle East is from tribes. And I was talking about that on my chat show to a Middle East expert. And I did talk about the Sunnis and the S's and S's. It's in Iran and Iraq. And he said to me, don't go there. This is being recorded. We better not discuss this. You know, and you go, even if you go to Britain and you go to Northern Ireland, it's Catholics and Protestants. And also in Glasgow, where one or two of my guests might be from, you know, Celtic's a Catholic football team and Rangers is a Protestant football team. And you should see what goes on when one of those local matches takes place. It's disgusting, really.
Wow.
It's sunny in chats.
Question, your chart didn't show, I think, China. Where would China be on it?
Well, I don't know is the answer. I'll be absolutely honest with you. And I don't know why it wasn't on it. It was drawn up in 2014. I think by an American, I think it was something in the Harvard Business Review.
I would think they'd be a player.
Maybe China's play has played a bit harder in the last in the last 6 years since your president noticed what was going on. I don't know. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I imagine China was a bit like Japan, but as the Chinese and the Japanese can't stand each other, and there's still a lot of bitterness over that situation, and there's some huge, huge issues going on in the South China Sea over natural resources and who owns the islands in the South China Sea.
I would think that Japan would be very different than China from what I know of the two cultures. Okay. That's why I was curious where it fit, because they can be very tough negotiators and you can't read them very well.
Yeah.
Stereotyping, obviously. But.
Well, they were going to pay me £5,000 a day to go and speak in Shanghai in April this year. But to be honest, I wasn't very keen on it because it's a 14-hour flight each way. And this was pre-COVID. And I actually turned it down because I thought I'd be exhausted by the time I got there. Kind of didn't need it really, but yeah, it would have been interesting. I spoke to a huge number of Chinese ladies that were studying at Cambridge University on a summer semester last year. They were lovely. They were charming. They couldn't have been nicer. But it was interesting. It was 90% women and 10% men that they'd sent to sent halfway across the world to be at Cambridge University.
Thank you. Very interesting.
Betty had a similar question, but did Derek answer the question for you too, Betty?
He did. Thank you, Derek. That was my question. But I do have another question. I've heard many, I am in real estate, and I've heard a gentleman by the name of Chris Voss who's a negotiator, and it's never split the difference. And in other words, you don't give in at all. His history, I guess, is as a hostage negotiator. And I've heard him in person, and I'm the win-win person. I want to make it. This is how I negotiate. And I just didn't like that. How do you feel about never split the difference? Maybe in life and death, it's different, but not for me in real life.
Well, I've got his book and read it many times. It's a great book. It's got to be taken into context, Betty, I think. He was a New York hostage negotiator who got into some pretty tricky situations. Mm-hmm. And I think that was hostage negotiation rather than real estate negotiations. And I've interviewed a couple of chief constables. They're the people that are in charge of the counties in the UK on negotiation. Negotiations changed quite a bit by the police in this country in the last 20 years. They didn't used to carry guns. They carry guns now. You might be surprised about that, that they didn't carry guns. They're much more likely to get injured themselves. So the policing probably is a bit more like it was in America 10 years ago, I guess. So I think it depends whether we're negotiating a win-win business deal, more from the sales point of view, where we want a win-win, or basically we're trying to negotiate with someone who basically, most of his stories about situations, aren't they, of when there's hostages been taken, there may be people on drugs or on alcohol, to calm it down. The longer you can make it go on without anyone pulling the trigger, the more effective it can be. The goal usually is to get the person off the high and trade something with them, like food or switching the electricity back on in the house. It could be all sorts of little variables that he talks about. The one thing I did like about the book, which I hadn't thought about and is not in my book, is he says do an accusation audit when you've got a difficult negotiation. So audit what they're going to accuse you of before you go into the meeting. So, you know, this would be in a tough workout situation, perhaps a one-off. But yeah, do an accusation audit. And why wouldn't you? In fact, it's almost what we did in Paris, isn't it? We looked at every angle, but... it's quite sad that most people go into negotiations and spend about 10 minutes preparing, don't prepare their team, don't brief them what they're going to talk about, how they're going to talk about it. And when I ask, if I'm the lead negotiator, when I ask what I call a Columbo question, which is a Peter Falk question, which you'll no doubt most of you are old enough to remember Peter Falk from the Columbo series. So it's called a dummy smart question. You know, I don't quite understand where you're coming from, even though you do. A member of your team doesn't answer it for you. That's the biggest danger of the whole lot, isn't it? You ask this question. And when I was learning negotiations, teaching, studying it, several occasions with clients, we forgot to brief the team. And somebody on my side said something we didn't want them to say, you know, and you go, and then you take it as a learning, don't you? Always learning. We're always learning.
Thank you. Excellent.
Thank you, Betty.
Do we have any other questions?
Janice Litvin has one.
Janice has been waving her hand as long as we've been. And Janelle has a question. And I have a question of Janelle and Derek together, a situation. So if Janice goes first, and if I may, Mr. President, select Janelle next.
Absolutely. And also, I know Bill Buchanan has a question. So after that, maybe we can follow up with Bill. Go ahead, Patricia.
Janice.
Yes. Derek, thank you so much, Derek. Over the years, I've heard and read many negotiation books, and I loved every single thing you said. One thing I would ask you is, in the heat of battle, our amygdala takes over, our fear center, and we might get nervous. And so really the question is, it's one thing to learn these techniques and to be prepared and to have everything written down. It's another thing to learn through doing. And so you don't want to wait till a hot negotiation to do your learning. So the question is, how do people get the practice, and how can one learn, do that learning?
Okay, well, the first thing is my speech coach, Patricia Fritt, would pick up straight away the word you used, which was battle. So if you treat a negotiation as a battle, I guess that's what you'll get, a battle, as opposed to a win-win situation where you want, as Dale Carnegie famously said in 1930, if you help the other person get what they want, then you can get what you want. So first of all, I'd be trying to find out by my research, by looking at on the website, everybody that knows this person through my 4,500 LinkedIn contacts, and I'd love to have any of you as a LinkedIn contact on my briefing, on my newsletter, and Patricia can give you the details, or I will, because the more people you know, the more information that you can find out. It's fabulous, the networking we can do. So if we can lose the word battle for a start, first of all, and I'm sure the mandibula was a part of the brain as opposed to a country in Africa. I wasn't sure which it was.
Read my book and then you'll learn all about it.
Yeah, I'll give you my address in a minute. You can send it to me. By the way, my book's only $12 on Amazon.com at the moment. I looked it up just now and you can get the Kindle version even cheaper. So it'll be on your desk in a minute. I look forward to reading your book, seriously.
Thank you.
So the way we talk to ourselves clearly is going to affect how we approach the negotiation. So if we can find out what they want, compromise with them, etc., that's going to help a lot. Preparation, 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 like a presentation. You cannot do enough preparation. Then preparing your team. You should always take somebody with you to an important negotiation, one that meets the 80-20 rule, you know, the et cetera. And therefore, when you take a break and a timeout, you can ask the other person what they saw, what they heard, what they thought, how much we should reduce our position. If they get aggressive, you can perhaps sit back, play a bit of the body language, watch what they're going on. And I love the word curious. I learned the word curious from my NLP training, but just to say quietly, I'm curious where you're coming from. You know, with a bit of turn the head like my dog does, you know, furrowed brow, bit of a scratch of the head like Lieutenant Columbo, and just say that. Because again, you can say aggressive things with a very quiet tone of voice, and people with other tonality, like animals, rather than the actual, well, where are you coming from, etc. So that will be my answer to that, Janice. It's a mindset. The reach out to.
I actually have a quick follow-up question.
Okay.
And I know this will relate to a lot of people in here. When you're trying to do a win-win on money, because I think money is a different kind of animal, and I think Betty will agree. They used to say the first person to mention money first loses. I don't 100% agree with that. But when someone calls you up and says, what do you charge for a 30-minute speech? You want to know their budget. So then I take it back and say, let me ask you a bunch of questions. How many people at blah, 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 blah. And then you're always trying to slide in, well, what was your budget? What did you say your budget was? A lot of times they never budge and give you the budget. So you just go for it and give them the amount you want. And sometimes the answer is no. And you always want to get to a yes, yes, rather than a no.
Negotiating speeches is a particularly interesting topic at the moment, particularly with Zoom. So I gave a client three options last week. My full works, my full fee to anchor the price up high.
Yeah.
And while I've lost a couple of speeches recently because I found out somebody would do it for nothing. Same thing that I pitched at.
Right.
Small pools, somebody will do it for nothing on Zoom. I don't want to lose any business at the moment because of COVID. And if I can help people. So I've said, I don't know what you've got in your budget. I don't know what you're paying other people, but because I've known you for a long time, et cetera, I will do it for whatever they quote, but I'll do it on Zoom. I will do it on the basis that you will promise me some other business when this is all over. Now, some of my colleagues in the Speaking Association would say, never do that, never compromise your own fee. But I, you know, I see them driving around in old cars and old jumpers. They don't have a smart suit on and a smart tie. And I judge people on what they look like rather than what they say. So I think it's tricky. We're in a tricky business at the moment. I know a lot of people aren't in the speaking business, and we're all consultants. Right. So I've just been testing the water. But if it's a relationship client, then they've got a problem at the moment. And if we can help them out the problem, right, but at the same time, do what Gildini says, make sure they know that we're doing it for them as a one-off.
Yeah.
And sometimes you might invoice them your full fee and then put discounted by 90% because of the relationship.
Yeah, I like that. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for your question.
I think we have time for one more question, and Bill Buchanan has been raising his hand the whole time. So, Bill, why don't you go ahead and ask the final question? And it's getting close to 9 o'clock, so we'll end the meeting after that.
Good morning, Derek. Thanks very much for a great presentation. I hope my question rises to the quality of my frequency of hand raising. But anyway, it just sitting here thinking to myself, whenever we have a world-class professional presenter, I'm thinking, gee, do we have time? Do I have time to really expand my research and knowledge in this? But I'm thinking to myself as you're talking how frequently negotiations does enter into our everyday lives. Like, you know, all the way from low stakes, like Sunday morning, Claire and I negotiating over Eggs Benedict or omelet. You know,
yeah, no, I get it. Yeah.
But, or as struck me the other day, the really high stakes, and you've already mentioned one of them, the START treaty, you know, missiles in Cuba and stuff like that. You know, that's about as high a stake as you can get as far as negotiation goes. And all of a sudden, we have this situation where the United Arab Emirates and Israel now have diplomatic relations. Boom, all of a sudden, and all of the you know, the ripples of effects on the other countries on whatever side they are. Let me ask you this question. Do you, when you hear about something like this recent agreement, do you go back and do kind of a case study and try to see where all these principles you had on your flip chart fit into that negotiation?
I think about it all the time. I hope you don't mind me building rapport with you and putting the sunset from the Denver National Speakers Association conference that I delighted to meet a few friends, and Patricia Fripp introduced me to my hero Brian Tracy and Nido Cobain and all those people I fly 9,000 miles for. I'm suspicious about that deal, Bill. I'm suspicious about that deal. There's another agenda flying around. Are we still being recorded? I'm not sure what I should say here, but it's very funny. I mean, it's
the United Arab Emirates. We're still on the recording.
I can stop the recording if you'd like to.
No. Yeah, Patricia thinks you should. Yeah, okay.